Live from Liverpool, this is The Morning Break with Tom Rogers on Teachers Talk Radio.
Good morning, everybody, and welcome to The Morning Break on Thursday, the 13th of May. Today, I've got a very special guest, which is Guy Claxton, who's joining us live to talk about his latest book and a lot of other stuff too. So, welcome. Good morning. Grab your drink. Sit down, relax, listen to The Morning Break.
Live from Liverpool, this is The Morning Break with Tom Rogers on Teachers Talk Radio. Tune in live on the Podbean app or desktop player. Just head over to www.podbean.com/lsw/ttradio or search Teachers Talk Radio. Follow the hashtag TTRadio.
Good morning, everybody, and we've had a text in from Freya, our fellow Teachers Talk Radio host, saying morning, 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 morning. How is Rome? I always cry, Freya, when I think about you in Rome and me in, well, I don't know. Liverpool's not too bad, actually. I've got to be, yes, sunny. I thought it would be. She's texted in and said sunny. Predictable. Yeah, it's not that sunny here. Guy has joined us already in the studio, which is fantastic. Guy, if you want to hit that phone icon at the top or the call-in icon at the top, we can start the conversation. But Freya, good morning. I'm glad it is sunny in Rome. And Kate Jones has shared the show. And Freya O'Dell has also shared the show too, which is good. Kate says hi from Abu Dhabi. Yes, it'll be sunny there too. So frustrating, all these people. How fantastic that you're all sunny and I'm not. Good morning, Guy. How are you?
Good morning, Tom. I'm fine, thank you very much. How are you?
Well, I'm just currently getting depressed about the weather here compared to two of our listeners already who are in Rome and Abu Dhabi, where the weather is better than the northwest of England at the moment, I'd suggest.
Oh, I'd rather be on a Greek island, but there we are.
Do you reckon?
Yeah, that's my spiritual home.
Oh, really? Is that the summer holiday destination of choice?
Well, it's booked, but whether we'll get there, who knows?
That sounds good to me. Listen, thank you so much for taking out some time to speak to me on The Morning Break on Teachers Talk Radio this morning, Guy.
Not at all. It's a pleasure.
Now, I was trying to figure out, because in terms of an introduction, because it feels like you've done so much. I was looking back at your kind of career and you've done, it would be kind of remiss of me to say your one thing. So I might actually ask you, I know you're an author, a thinker, a contributor to various different forums. Goodness me, I could literally go on and on and on. Cognitive scientist. Kate's helping me out here. She's literally dropping things that you are into the chat, Guy, which sounds a bit strange when you're actually here live. But what would you describe yourself as?
Oh, blimey. well, I'm basically, professionally, I'm a cognitive scientist, which means that I'm trained to read technical literatures that bear on our understanding of the human mind. So things like linguistics, experimental psychology, philosophy, artificial intelligence, neuroscience, and so on. That's my kind of professional background. That's what I did my degrees in. But most of my working life has been in trying to apply what I'm learning and reading and researching from cognitive science to what goes on in classrooms. So I'm an educator and an author and a bit of an egghead, I suppose.
I like that. Bit of an egghead. Yeah, that's fantastic. So listen, I mean, in this interview today, we're going to cover a lot of things. We're going to talk about your new book, The Future of Teaching and the Myths That Hold It Back, which I'm really excited about, which I had the opportunity to read in the last few days myself. Also, we're going to talk about some of the other talks and speeches that you've given, including your TED Talk. And maybe a bit about you as well, sure. In terms of your life, I guess. Some other bits to thrown in.
I can reserve the right to pass.
You You can pass whenever you wish, and there will be okay. I promise there will be nothing too difficult to answer. Well, hopefully, anyway, but okay.
We'll see.
Don't worry, don't panic. The book. Let's start with the book. So let's go pre-publication. What kind of inspired you to write this book? What was the thinking behind that?
Well, it's a very different. I think the first thing to say is it's a very different book from the kind of book I usually write. And people who know my writing will know me more as a kind of as an advocate for particular styles of teaching or ways of thinking about the purposes of education. And that's sort of basically what I am, really. I try and promote the positive. But for about the last, 8 or 9 years, I've been aware of a particular kind of what I think of as sort of extreme view, which has gained quite a lot of attention and has been picked up by politicians and used for their own purposes, which is basically claiming that the most traditional kind of teaching, sort of chalk and talk, or what I call explain, practice, test and retest, that kind of teaching is the only kind of teaching which is legitimated or underpinned or authorized by cognitive science. In other words, it's the only style of teaching that is compatible with what the adherents of this view call the fundamental architecture of the mind. So, you know, me as a cognitive scientist, I don't really recognize, when I started to read some of these claims, I don't really recognize the cognitive science that they're drawing on. A lot of it seemed to me quite old hat and certainly much more contentious than they are claiming. And quite kind of carefully cherry picked as well, I thought. So I felt that most teachers teach in some kind of dynamic middle ground, if you like, between the sort of the stereotypes of progressive and traditional. You know, we explain a bit, we give kids activities, we let them struggle for a bit. We might do a bit of group work, then we might, you know, come back together and explain. So there's like lots of different threads that every teacher that I know weaves together. Yet this claim, and it's a very strong claim because it's like science says, right? Capital S, science says that only the most didactic form of teaching is the only thing that works. It was a very influential paper claiming that it's the only thing that works and everything else doesn't work. And I thought somebody needed to push back against this. So hence the book.
Okay, that's interesting. Just to pick up on what you were saying about these kind of contentious selections from cognitive science, can you start by giving me some examples of what you mean there, or some examples of these contentious selections?
Well, the most important thing, yeah, of course, the claim, the sort of the central claim, as I say, is around, and it's interesting, the language, the terminology that the proponents of this view, and it's in the area of sort of the most direct instruction or explicit instruction or what have you, didactic teaching or whatever. I've lost my thread. What was I talking about?
So we were saying the content. So what you would say contentious selections.
Right, yeah. Right. The vocabulary. So it all revolves around a particular model of memory, or as I say, these people use the architecture of cognition, and it's a very venerable model in psychology. And the very simple version says that the mind is is a bit like a computer. If you take the back off a computer, you can see different bits plugged together, and there's a bit called the central processing unit, and there's a bit called the RAM, and there's a bit called the hard drive. So people when I was an undergraduate back in the 1960s, doing my graduate work in the early 1970s, this model was all the rage. It's like The digital computer was the latest thing, and it provided what people thought was a very fruitful metaphor for thinking about the structure, or as I say, this word architecture of the mind. But remember, these are all metaphors. It's like using the phrase the architecture of the mind. It's like already that presupposes, well, what do you think of when you think of as architecture? I immediately think of something like the Parthenon. You know, it's like it's big, it's lasted for 2,000 years, it's structural, it doesn't change, you know. So there is this assumption that the mind is built up of these solid, enduring structures, and the two most important of which are called working memory and long-term memory. And the original model said you have to squeeze everything through this narrow channel called working memory to get it into long-term memory.
Yes, and there is actually a chapter in your book, isn't there, on memory, the architecture of the mind, which is chapter 6 in the book. Yep. And some of this, essentially in this chapter, just to focus on that first, because you've touched on it, but within that chapter, you essentially challenge the way in which, would I be right in saying you challenged the way in which the mind is talked about, the way in which the memory is talked about in terms of the language that's used and so on?
In terms of the way this model has been imported into educational discourse over the last, I don't know, 15, 20 years or so, and presented as if it were God's truth, basically, and used then to justify this didactic method of teaching with a very curious argument, which says because everything you learn has to squeeze through this sort of narrow vestibule into the mind called the working memory, we have to worry all the time about what's called cognitive load. We mustn't try and squeeze too much through this tube, through this narrow tube, this conduit into memory. But one thing we can do, and this is you know, I find slightly strange, is to fill long-term memory up with as much knowledge, and knowledge is often talked about in some of the literature here as if it were just facts, right? Fill long-term memory up with as many facts as possible, and then somehow or other that will mitigate the constraints of this narrow channel. And I mean, that's not really the way the mind works. The first thing to say is that this model of the mind, which is still around and it still has some adherence and some currency, was originated on the basis of very particular kinds of laboratory experiments with getting people to remember very peculiar kinds of things. Basically, strings of random numbers, random digits, or strings of random words. Now, we very rarely have to do that in everyday life. Sometimes when you're remembering a phone number before you've put it into your contacts list, or maybe when you're remembering a shopping list if you hadn't bothered to write it down. But most of the time, we understand, it's like our goal is to piece what we're hearing together and create a kind of mental representation of it on the basis of what we already know. It's like doing a jigsaw puzzle. Inside your head, there's a large unfinished jigsaw puzzle, and whenever you're tossed a new few pieces of the jigsaw, the way the mind is built from my point of view is, you know, you immediately try and fit it into the jigsaw. And you may get that right or you may get it wrong. You may have to undo it a little bit, but that's the first thing you have to do. So it's kind of strange to build this apparently, you know, unchanging model of the mind on kinds of situations, having to learn, you know, it's like a computer says to you 7 4 3 9 4 2 1 8 7 5 6 3 1 2, and you have to repeat them all back. Now, I don't know any classroom that does that. You know, I know classrooms where teachers explain things, they use metaphors, they draw on your personal experience. Certainly most of my teaching was like that. And very rarely, just occasionally, you might meet things that seem to bear no relationship to what you already know. It's like, you know, I always struggled with the square root of -1, you know, because it's like there's nothing you can hang that onto. It's very, so occasionally you might come across things like that, but not very often. And in science, for example, when you're learning science, when you meet a new concept, usually it'll be introduced to you via some kind of metaphor. You know, electricity is like little electrons being shuffled down a tube, or the atom is like a little miniature solar system, right? Immediately, you're trying to make sense of what you hear it, rather than just remembering it. So understanding is the primary thing that we do, which is what you and I are doing now, right? You know, I'm not aware of any cognitive load constraints in listening to what you're saying, and I hope you're not having that experience when you listen to me. It's not like you're having to hang on to lots of separate beads that don't seem to be strung on a thread yet. You know, we're hearing and we're understanding. So it seems strange to import into a complex situation like the classroom, which is all about developing competence and comprehension, a model of the mind which was originally designed to cope with what the mind does when it's learning nonsense.
Interesting. I mean, I've read the chapter. I've read the book, but I really enjoyed it, by the way. I thought
Oh,
it was
good. Thank you,
really
Alan.
well. I thought I'd say that because I haven't said that yet, but it was really well written. Interesting. There's things I want to question you about. There's things I want to ask you about, and one of them is the thread through the book is this idea that memorizing facts seems to be a bit of a bugbear of yours. So, is so I guess. You know, from, I mean, you do acknowledge in the book on several occasions that, you know, obviously you say, you know, knowledge is important. People knowing things is important,
Yeah, of course
and
it is.
so
Of course
on. But what's your issue with this idea of memorizing facts? Or I mean, in one point you picked out the idea of the knowledge organizer, which has obviously become very, very popular
Yeah.
certainly in British education circles.
Yeah.
You pick that out for kind of a bit of punishment. And what's your issue here with this idea of memorizing facts?
Well, what use are they? It depends what the facts are. As I say, you know, I don't have a problem. My let me let's get clear about one thing, Tom. My book is not a progressive pushing back against all traditional teaching methods. That's not my fight. The issue for me is pushing back against a claim that only traditional teaching methods, only listening, memorizing, repeating, and practicing, that that's the only valid model of cognition. That's what I'm pushing back against. So I'm not against, you know, I learned my timetables in a little village school in Shropshire, and we all, by singing them, right? Yeah, we chanted them. I don't have a problem with that. Some people do. Some people think, you know, but I'm not one. Some people think that rote learning is some kind of deep insult to the delicate little human mind. I think rote learning is perfectly good for learning certain kinds of things, but the way you learn things will depend on the use that you want to make of them, won't it? It's like, what's the point of learning this?
Yeah, I mean, I was gonna ask you about it because in the book a couple of times, I picked out that phrase actually. You use the word useless or useless knowledge or useless facts or you know, what's the point kind of thing. And like, I mean, can you give me some examples of that? Because would there be an argument to say that? I mean, I think you did give an example of, I can't remember the poem, but you gave an example of memorizing parts of a poem. And as kind of useless, you know, knowledge basically, or useless to learn by rote, by heart.
I don't
And
I don't remember that example, but let's
oh,
say.
okay, I'd have to find it in here. But let's see if I can find it. But it was essentially saying, you know, there is some knowledge that is useless to learn by rote. And I guess I was going to ask you what you think that is, basically.
Well, let's be I mean I let's be slightly more nuanced here. It's not a matter of some is useful and some is useless. It's like, you know, what is the utility of what you're learning? Under what circumstances is it going to help you to lead a successful, flourishing, responsible life? Right? That for me is the question. Sometimes that question gets shrunk to what's going to help me get an A on the test. But my concern always is, I mean, part of where I'm coming from in this book is to say it's very timely and urgent and important that we don't assume that part that knowledge for knowledge's sake or knowledge for the sake of passing tests is a sufficient goal for education. You know, that's, I think, just settling on the near horizon, what I call the near horizon of, you know, GCSE results, A-level results, university entrance, of education as a preparation for yet more education. I think we have to be a bit more ambitious than that. And I don't know anybody, I haven't come across a single school that says on the homepage of its website, send us your kids and we will do everything we can by hook or by crook, at whatever cost, to squeeze grades out of your child and nothing else. There's always something else that is claimed as being of value, helping them become a citizen, to become an active participant in, become ready for a lifetime of learning or something or other. Every website nods in the direction of the acquisition of knowledge for passing grades and tests is necessary but not sufficient as a goal of education. Would you not agree?
Yes, I would agree that that is on a lot of schools' websites and so on. I really would. I think my question would be, because I know in the book you kind of, I was going to ask you, I mean, I was going to ask you broadly, really, what is the DI, is it the DIKR lobby or the DIKR people, as you say in a few parts of the book? What is this? And that kind of links into what you're asking there in terms of because what my experience, I guess, is from visiting schools that are proponents of direct instruction and knowledge-rich curriculums and teaching, isn't necessarily that the things you say they don't do, that they don't do. As in, for example, in a lesson in school that is, if you like, in inverted commas, traditional, a chalk and talk lesson, let's call it in the old school way of saying it, with a heavy reliance on maybe testing, memorization, and so on, and teaching knowledge, teaching a set of things. Can I mean, my experience is that there is critical thinking in that lesson. There is,
Well, there may or may not be, right?
yeah, but you could say that about a lesson that was built around inquiry learning or discovery learning, could you? To say there's no guarantee in that lesson there's going to be critical thinking either.
Well, there's going to be, I mean, let's lay another thing to rest. You can do, if we're talking about extremes at the moment, which I don't particularly want to, but if we're talking about extremes, then you can do either of those extremes well or badly, can't you? You can do traditional teaching badly. You
Yeah, definitely.
can misjudge the level. You can read out your lecture notes. You can get kids copying down swathes of stuff off the blackboard. You can do it in a dull, dispiriting, mindless way. Likewise, you can do progressive teaching in a way in which kids are running around like headless chickens, not knowing what they're doing. Everything is laissez-faire and, well, what do you want to do, sweetheart? And nothing of any value is being learned, right? So you can do either of these things in a way that is well done or badly done. Part of the problem with the sort of stereotyping is that, people who are broadly of a progressive persuasion, their attention is on the sort of what I call the bright side of what being progressive means. It means encouraging kids to be curious or collaborative or imaginative or self-reliant or resourceful and so on. And when a sort of dyed-in-the-wool progressive looks at the traditional way of teaching, they tend to see what I call the shadow side of traditional teaching. People who are becoming more dependent on their teachers, extrinsically motivated, only worried about exam results, perhaps more unimaginative. Conversely, when a dyed-in-the-wool traditionalist looks at his or her preferred approach. They see the bright side. They see we're helping kids become more knowledgeable, more studious, more disciplined, learning to read and think in a solo fashion on their own. And they see the dark side, the shadow side of progressives. They see something which is self-indulgent or undisciplined or irresponsible or feral, or, you know, it's like Lord of the Flies all over again, right? So we've got these two, you know, if you set this up as the two tribes, which is precisely what my book is trying to get beyond, then you've got this, these sort of, you know, these two people playing sort of tug of war, like sort of fighting with the worst stereotype of each other. They see the best stereotype for themselves and the worst stereotype of other people. So I think that's rather unprofitable, don't you?
I mean, I think your first chapter is called Punch and Judy, and the kind of Punch and Judy show between the so-called trads and the so-called progs. Yeah. I think that, however, one thing I would ask is, so if you're saying like the direct instruction knowledge rich lobby or the direct instruction knowledge rich people, is yeah. there a so-called, because to me that sounds quite, if you like, aim towards the tradition, the trads, right? No, or not? Or you're saying that somebody
as I said earlier, what I'm aiming at is a particular extreme version of people who say the most traditional teaching is the only way, is the only valid form of teaching, and they draw sustenance from this widely quoted paper. I can't remember the title of it, by Kirshner, Sweller and Clark, 2006, which claims that everything that isn't traditional teaching, and the title lumps together inquiry learning, discovery learning, constructivism, a whole lot of broad brush things, and then the phrase comes, don't work, or a failure, right?
Yeah.
So anything that is not built around the teacher explaining everything up front is dismissed as ineffective or damaging or invalid according to cognitive science. That's what I'm getting at in this book, not people who weave together, as most teachers do, bits of explanation and bits of exploration, right? That's what I see in most classrooms. But anything of the exploratory kind, like inquiry learning or grappling with a challenging problem on your own, is dismissed as being, as I say, invalid, damaging, or illegitimate according to the science. That's what I'm pushing back against.
Okay, so what in this sense, what, just to kind of dig in a little bit further with that, in terms of trying to translate it into classroom practice, trying to think about it. So you mentioned actually in the book at one point, and we'll come on to that later, about behavior, about kind of like the classroom management element of it. And I mean, this is only my experience, by the way. This isn't based on kind of a research paper or anything like that. This is just my experience of being a classroom teacher, is that I find it harder, significantly harder, to manage a classroom that where the desks are in pods, where there is a discovery learning or inquiry based learning approach, where the students are working in groups, where there is a lot of flexibility over what they do, how they how they interact with each other, the way in which they put ideas forward. Now, in my kind of heaven, version of teaching, this would be fantastic. So in a university context, that would be fantastic, and that's right. What I experienced in university, and
you don't have lecture theatres full of people mucking about, do you?
Well, not generally. I think they want to be there. They want to be there, and they and also I have to say as well, and Freya's texted in an international context. I know she teaches in Rome, but and I agree. When I was teaching out in Spain, maybe there was you know, with the kind of, but hey, it was a private international school, and at the end of the day, you know, there was more scope maybe to, mm-hmm. for me to do lessons like that, yeah, because of the classroom management and behavior element. Now, my point is that students sat in rows, being taught in a broadly direct instruction, knowledge-rich curriculum, knowledge-rich style, retrieval quiz, knowledge, you know, in a kind of structure like that, is easier. Yep. is significantly easier.
Yep.
to manage as, yep, a teacher, particularly a newer, yep, teacher.
Yep.
And I wanted to put to you that the danger of diminishing this approach, regardless of the research behind, you know, I'm not actually disputing, you know, you're an expert in this field, so I'm not actually disputing the research behind these things. The theory behind these things is not what I'm disputing. I suppose what I'm asking is the practice of saying, yep, you know what, we reject this approach in a state school, deprived area context, mm, and we're going to go for this instead, and we're going to open it. We're not going to have classroom walls. We're going to have glass screens. We're going to, you know, this is an extreme example, but you get my point. So yeah. I guess what I'm asking is how do you feel? How do you think this, if you like, rejection of this one structure approach ties in with classroom practice?
yeah, it's a really good question, Tom. And
yeah.
and I think, excuse me, privately, that I think quite a lot of the, what you're putting your finger on is something very important, which is quite a lot of the people who I've come across who have adopted a kind of strong direct instruction, chalk and talk approach,
yeah,
are sort of disappointed idealists. You know, it's like they, you know, they tried, or they wanted to, a bit like you were describing. You know, they would like to have taught or organized their teaching in a more progressive way. Progressive in quotes. And they did. They tried it, and they had a bad experience.
Yeah,
right.
I think there's some truth in that.
I think they've concluded from that it doesn't work. But especially with groups of kids who lack sort of basic self-regulation, who don't know how to sit down, be quiet, listen to each other, put their hands up. They know how to contribute to a discussion, and so on. And I absolutely understand that, and I agree with it. However, they could have drawn another conclusion, which is, and this is, now I'm going to use something, a slightly cheesy thing from Carol Dweck, which is, it's not that these youngsters can't are incapable of coping with that kind of teaching. It's just that they can't do it yet. And that therefore part of our job as a teacher is, and I've seen this happen in hundreds and hundreds of schools, often in many deprived areas, is to teach from the point of view that our job is gradually and systematically to help children grow their capacity to be able to handle the degree of autonomy or collaborative nature of teaching from which they will benefit. It's our job,
yeah,
to coach the development of that. So someone who dabbled with being more progressive and got stung by it could have concluded, I went too far with that group, or I assumed that they could do too much, or I pitched it at the wrong level for them. In other words, they could have concluded that this is difficult, precisely as you say, it's a more complex model of teaching. But they could have said, oh, I have something to learn here. Perhaps I should have started more gradually. Instead of just trying to jump into a whole lot of group work, I might have said, talk to your partner for 30 seconds about this, and then we'll come back to whole class teaching. And then if they can manage that, maybe we could do it for a minute, and then we could have three people together for 3 minutes, and then we could gradually build up their capacity to discover for themselves that disciplined discussion is a fruitful way of learning. Do you see what I'm on about?
I do. I'll tell you what, Guy, because I think that's a fantastic chat, and we're going to actually continue on with it. Do you mind if I play the news and a bit of a competition for our amazing listeners as well? We've actually had a couple of texts in just based on what you were saying. Mr. Kringle says, yes, yes, yes. I think he's agreeing with you, Guy.
And, that's good.
And Freya says, absolutely, with a clap emoji. So there's a couple of comments there saying, fantastic. And also Kate Jones says, this is a fantastic chat. I will listen back to the podcast later. So some excellent comments so far. So I'm just going to play the news, and then we'll come back to exactly what we were talking about, because I don't think we're finished on it.
Okay, very good. Thanks, Dom.
Stay right where you are.
This is Teachers Talk Radio, and this is Teachers Talk Radio News with Megan Goods.
This is your latest Teachers Talk Radio News. The union, GMB, has conducted a survey on the nation's attitudes to teaching assistants. 74% of those questioned felt that the average teaching assistant's earnings, around £13,856 in 2020, were too low. Whilst three quarters argued that support staff should be more valued by society. A spokesperson for the union called teaching assistants the glue that keeps children's education together and stated, these results show that they are rightly valued by the public, and now it's time for the government and employers to catch up. Lord Michael Storey, a Liberal Democrat peer, is pushing for a bill which could see essay writing services banned in Britain amid fears students are cheating their way into jobs. The bill would make it illegal to provide or advertise the service. Lord Storey feels the free availability of contracted essay writing may bring academic credibility into question. Data from the Quality Assurance Agency for Higher Education shows essay mill services are on the rise in Britain, from 635 in June 2018 to at least 932 sites as of February 2021, indicating an increase in demand as school and university students worked from home. Schools in Scotland have received a warning from the Scottish Qualifications Authority after students were found sharing details of ongoing assessments on TikTok. The SQA suggested schools prioritise maintaining the security and confidentiality required for the integrity of the assessments and to ensure fairness for students. It called for schools to investigate malpractice and apply appropriate penalties. That was your daily education news briefing.
Live from Liverpool, this is The Morning Break with Tom Rogers on Teachers Talk Radio.
Yo, yo, everybody. Good morning. I hope everybody is doing well. If you're listening back to this as a podcast because you happen to be teaching at the time, well, I hope you're enjoying it. If you're listening live, welcome. I hope you're enjoying your PPA or whatever you're doing right now to be able to listen. You are joining us live with Guy Claxton, talking about his latest book. Really enjoying the chat so far, The Future of Teaching.
Live from Liverpool, this is The Morning Break with Tom Rogers on Teachers Talk Radio. Tune in live on the Podbean app or desktop player. Just head over to www.podbean.com/lsw/ttradio or search Teachers Talk Radio. Follow the hashtag TTRadio.
Guy, are you still with us?
Yes, I certainly am.
Wonderful. Are you enjoying the chat so far?
Yes, very much. We're really getting down to the nitty gritty. It's great.
Yeah, I'm liking it. I was just before the news, we were discussing this idea of a new teacher who enters the profession and they have the kind of, and I've been there with the kind of stars in my eyes and the kind of halo over my head. And, you know, somebody telling me to do this activity and that activity and do things this way and that way, and what I guess people might term a progressive style of teaching or way of doing things.
Sure.
And you've then over time they've realized, you know what, this ain't working. It doesn't work. It does not. It is not compatible with classroom management. It's not compatible yep. with being able to build a classroom culture. Here's another option, which is more simple, structured. There's routines.
Yeah.
It's what we might call in the old style of chalk and talk, right?
Yeah.
And it's working for me, and that's what I'm going to do.
Yep.
What's wrong with that?
Well, I think there's nothing wrong with it as a launch pad. I mean, have you read the book? You'll know that I analyze
yeah.
what the Michaela Community School say about themselves in their two published books. Because what I'm getting at in this book is not, you know, I'm not attacking particular individuals, people whose views might have changed or might have moved on, but there is a small number of publications that have had a very powerful impact. So what I'm saying, let's take Michaela. You know, if it's the case that a lot of the kids who go to Michaela arrive with for whatever reason, without any judgment, relatively low levels of this kind of, you know, basic self-regulation that I was talking about before, the ability to remember to bring their stuff, to sit down, to be polite, to listen to each other, to put their hands up, to not call out, all that basic stuff. I don't have any problem with a kind of tough discipline that trains those youngsters in those basic life skills. Don't have any problem with that at all. I think that's a really good launch pad to develop, you know, that kind of, as I say, the sort of the social skills of listening, of being able to ask questions articulately and politely, and, you know, to be responsible, to remember to bring your stuff, all that kind of stuff. I don't have a problem with that. The only problem comes when that becomes presented as the only way to teach, because I see that as training kids, giving them a kind of launch pad of good manners or civility or self-discipline or whatever you like, on which you can build a whole lot of other things, a whole lot of other attributes, which are also valuable, like curiosity, like conversation, like oracy, like creativity, like critical thinking, and so on. So whereas particularly in the first Michaela book, they say very clearly, you know, it's like with the facts, the discipline, it's like you get a detention for every little thing. You know, I don't have a problem with that, but I would like to say, okay, now we've got these kids to the point where they can behave civilly, where we've created their not just their ability to be in a calm, orderly classroom, but their understanding of the value of that, right? So it's like they're owning it. They're not subjected to it by a teacher who's constantly creating the discipline. In the second Michaela book, I really agree with and appreciate the emphasis that Catherine Birbal-Singh puts on the importance of the culture, of developing the culture in the school and building these habits of behavior and habits of mind. Where I part company with Catherine is that I would say, now we've got that calm, orderly atmosphere where the teacher isn't having to keep the lid on the pressure cooker the whole time. Now we can build other habits of mind. We can get kids doing more difficult things. We can have them trying to work out solutions to problems collaboratively. And that doesn't lead to disciplinary issues. But what it does lead to is the building of useful, I've used this phrase, habits of mind, like inquiry and collaboration and turn-taking and all those kinds of things, which are really useful out there in the real wide world, aren't they? You know, it's like,
yeah,
if you're going to evaluate fake news that you come across on Facebook, or if you're going to set up your own little business, you need to be imaginative, you need to be entrepreneurial, you need to have a critical disposition towards what you read. Those are really useful attributes to have if you're going to be alive and thriving in the 21st century. So from my view of education, we should be always looking to move in that direction, not just assuming that we have to keep the lid on the whole time.
I guess, and I can't speak for Catherine, I have visited Michaela, and it was fantastic, and I'm a big admirer of, you know, I make no secret of that, of Catherine person.
Me too. You mean you'll remember in my book that section is entitled Two Cheers for Michaela.
Yeah, I think your conclusion to the chapter was basically saying it's fantastic, is the bottom line. What you did say is that you there were things that you wanted to see them add,
yeah,
I think,
precisely.
To what they do.
That's but my, just what I'm
my yeah, and my I guess, and I can't speak for anybody from Michaela or any other school. But my thinking on that from reading that and also listening to that is I agree with a lot of what you're saying in this kind of Halcyon dream world. But my kind of challenge or my question on that would be, number one, it depends on the students. But even more so than that, there is a natural text. Let me give you an actual practical example.
Yep.
Let's say I've had a class in my career, and I can think of lots like this, where I've taught them in a very structured, didactic fashion over a period of time, coupled with very high expectations, and I've picked up on everything. And, you know, the kind of, if you like, the Michaela model of discipline that we've talked about, or whatever you want to call that, right? Yep. High expectations, really high expectations, picking on it, whatever, right? And I've taught them that way. After a few months, they have personalities. And the thing is, if I was to have just gone, right, we're gonna stop this, and we're gonna change the way we do things completely. And suddenly, because you've, if you like, got used to this system and proven that you've behaved well in this style of me teaching you, we're now gonna either gradually or quickly change to this style of teaching. And maybe this is my fault, because maybe this is my lack of trust, but it's only built on my experience over time. Is I feel that I don't think those children will have changed fundamentally in their intrinsic behaviors as children because I've taught them in that way that's worked. I, you know, we're talking as if we teach that class for like a year successfully. Yeah. Yep. using a DI approach with very structured discipline, that those children will have got to a point where they've gone, right, I'm a changed child. I am, you know, I can see the value in behaving in this way and in talking to other people in this way and in having these basic manners in this way, and I can see it. So now I'm ready for discovery learning. I'm completely open to be corrected by anybody. Maybe my kind of paranoia and lack of trust in based, but it is that paranoia and lack of trust is based on my lived experience as a classroom teacher, to see that when that's happened to me, you know, I have let the reins go. Yeah. And then it, 9 times out of 10, depending on how far you go, it doesn't work. And some classes it will work, Guy. That's the thing. But again, it will be around the personalities of the children. It's not necessarily, you know, the classic, they're a great class. Well, with a great class, you're going to have a much better chance of being able to do what we're saying in this like university style seminar teaching.
Yeah, you know, but they don't say that at Michaela. They don't say, well, this was a great class, so we can do it with them.
No, because I'm sure they class.
What they're doing is training. They're coaching, they're changing, they're building habits of, and really importantly in Michaela, which I also applaud, which gets one cheer from me, they're constantly explaining why. So that it's not a kind of Mr. Gradgrind environment as it sometimes caricatured. There is a constant understanding constantly being reinforced about why we're being tough on you. We're being tough on you in order to build your, to increase the likelihood that you will lead happy and fulfilled and responsible and interesting lives.
Yeah.
And and they are changing those children's habits. There's no question about it. So there isn't, it's yeah. like, you know, that's what's good about Michaela. There isn't this, you know, it's like this seething pressure cooker and we're having to keep the lid on the whole time. No, these kids' characters do change for the better.
Just to cut in there as well, because I'm bringing out bits from what you said in the book here on this chapter, which you've covered on Michaela. You've said, the discipline at Michaela has to be gradually replaced by more trust and independence, which is essentially what you're saying here. Yeah. The bit that interested me is when you also said that they should articulate and evidence progression in character traits. I found that interesting and quite surprising in the sense of how would you suggest that a school, and I'm not just talking about Michaela here, but any school, evidence progression in character traits? Guy, you still there? Hello?
Yeah, I am. I lost you for a minute. Yeah.
Oh, no, sorry. No, we're back. We're back. Yeah, hello. I've got you.
Yeah, we're okay. Yeah.
I was just going to ask, like, what's... Yeah, sorry, sure. Go on.
No, I mean, this is getting us on to the other side of my work prior to the future of teaching and the myths.
Which is this learning river, right?
It's what I call the learning power approach. And it's like,
yes.
for about 3 years prior to writing.
Guy, I think we've lost you again. Could be your connection, possibly. I don't think it's mine. So I'll tell you what we'll do. I will disconnect you. And if you just call back in for me, and hopefully we can get you back on. And it should work, hopefully. So we've been talking to Guy about his new book. And I've been absolutely fascinated to hear this. It's the book's called The Future of Teaching and the Myths That Hold It Back by Guy Claxton, with a foreword by Dylan William. I read it in the last few days. Excellent. Very well written, very interesting. I've challenged Guy on a few things in there. I've asked him questions, and we're right in the middle of this discussion. Hopefully you can call back in a minute. I think there might have been some internet issues there or something. But one thing I have said, I've seen a lot of the comments coming in. Freya has texted in and said, with regards to this idea of kind of discovery or inquiry, does that mean we shouldn't do it though? I agree with you, Freya. I'm saying, like, that's me. I know other people would say, well, no, I reject that approach completely anyway. But for me, it's like, I don't. I actually have used that approach in the past. However, as time's gone on, I guess I've used it more sparingly, because I've realized that it has to be right. Hi, Guy. I think you're back with us. Yeah, I think we're having some connection issues. I think your connection keeps maybe dropping in and out. I'm not sure, because it's been fine the whole time. It just keeps fluctuating. Yeah, I think you've gone again. So if you want to try and maybe use your 4G, maybe don't use your Wi-Fi, try a different connection. Hopefully we can get you back. Hopefully we can get Guy back, because I was absolutely loving the conversation. But I think there's a signal problem maybe. The Wi-Fi seems to be dropping in and out a little bit there. So I'm not sure what's going on. But I was just saying, with regards to what Freya was saying about kind of the issue of approaching things through, say, group work or inquiry or discovery. And I was saying, my personal thing is, I want to do that. Yeah. I want to have that kind of seminar-based experience for kids. I've started using it more and more sparingly. I want to do it, but I just sometimes feel I can't do it, because I just feel it's not going to work. And that's my instinct telling me that. That's my experience as a teacher in that classroom telling me that. Guy, can you hear me okay? No, Guy, I think we're in trouble. I'll tell you what we'll do. If I am going to sort something out now and hopefully get you back on a different way. I'll tell you what you could do, Guy, if it's possible. If you can email me your phone number and I will give you a call and we'll do it old school. You can call me and we will stream our phone conversation live, which is a Malchus Nasami invention. Of the kind of speaker to the phone conversation on Teachers Talk Radio. But yeah, it's old school, but it surprisingly works. So if I will call you if you send me your phone number and we'll connect each other that way, because unfortunately I can't hear you anymore. I don't know whether your Wi-Fi has dropped out or something. I don't know, but I definitely can't hear you at the moment. Yeah, so maybe have a go at that, and I will try that, and hopefully we can bring you back for the last kind of 15 minutes or so of the show. Thanks everybody who's been tuning in, by the way, so far. Let's hear about our Teacher Talk Radio competition, because you've still got 10 days to enter it.
Do you have something to say about the future of education? Maybe you have some positive ideas about the way things could or should be in the future. Then enter our Teachers Talk Radio competition. Submit a 10-minute video presentation to us by 22nd of May, presenting your ideas about the future of education, and you could win £50. Our host team will select 5 winners who will each win £50 and have their video feature at a high-profile education event. To enter, simply send your video entry to teacherstalkradio@gmail.com with the subject line TTR Competition. We will announce the 5 winners after 22nd of May.
Hello, Guy Claxton. How are you doing?
Yes, Tom Rogers, are you there?
Yes, I can hear you. We're back in the old school.
I don't know where the technical problem is, I'm afraid. It's my end. I'm sorry, but everything looked okay from my end.
Yeah, I don't know what happened. It just decided it wanted to go on us, I think. But hopefully people can hear you. Let me know in the chat if you can hear Guy talking. Hopefully we can. This is our old school method of doing it on the mobile phone. So we'll see how things go. But we were just talking for the last 10 minutes. We were talking about this idea of kind of teaching from the front in a chalk and talk style versus not, and the fact I was saying that I am very sparing with when I actually do that with my classes. You're saying that through so you were giving the example of Michaela Free School, and you were saying that over time, through explaining the tough, you know, you were saying you had no problem with the tough discipline and the kind of rules and the structures and the systems, but you were saying that over time you thought that they could basically unleash the reins a little bit and have more trust and independence. And I guess I'm not, I've got to be honest, I'm not necessarily agreeing with that. I don't know is the answer to that. In my personal experience, I'd still be wary because children are children. And I think once you get to 16, 17, 18 years old, things change, things get easier. Kids are more mature. Kids have developed certain cognitive skills and skills of communication. They're able to do it. I don't know. Don't get me wrong. I'm not saying no kids are able. I'm just saying, in a classroom of 30, if you get 2 kids, 3 kids, 4 kids who are simply not able to do that, then I can tell you that when you spend 20 minutes of a lesson putting them all in pods doing group work, that's going to wreck it for every kid. Do you know what I mean? I'm not saying, don't get me wrong, you can have a skilled classroom manager and practitioner who will be able to minimize that disruption. But if you were to compare that situation to your kind of DI structured chalk and talk classroom, that probably wouldn't happen at all. That's the doorbell. That's somebody coming to basically back me up, Guy, in this argument, to say, you know what, I agree with Tom Rogers.
Don't worry about that. That's not going to happen. Well, our experience from Tom and our assumptions about human nature are different. I could take you to dozens of schools around the planet, many of them in areas of deprivation or high levels of stress, and you would be amazed at how no child is stepping out of line, how they are all able to discuss and disagree politely and respectfully, how they're able to know how to switch between creative and critical thinking as they approach a task, and so on. I could take you to School 21 in Newham.
Yeah.
I could take you to another school just down the road in Newham, a big school of 1,100 children in a primary school, a huge primary school in a big area of deprivation, where they're making my way of doing things work. But you have to do it. You have to teach in a particular way. You have to be clear about what the habits are that you want the kids to be developing. You have to be patient and relentless about building that culture. So my experience, and I'm a lot older than you are, my experience says if we really are committed to teaching in a way that develops character as well as transmits knowledge and builds literacy and gets good grades. Remember, it's always as well as, not instead of. If we're really committed to that and if we're smart and relentless about our ways of teaching, it can be done in whatever circumstances in which you find yourself. And I will accept no excuses because I've seen it happen in Bradford and Ellesmere Port and Newham and Ealing. So I have proof of concept that my ways work, whatever the kind of kids are that come into your school.
Yeah, I understand that. But I also think that, you know, I think that every school is different. Every context is different. I also think that the classroom teacher's experience may be different from the leader's experience or from, you know, I think we... Yeah, listen, I've visited lots of different schools. I've seen lots of different classrooms at work, and I don't necessarily disagree with you. I know about School 21. I know that these things can work. However, often it is contextual, and sometimes there are hidden contexts that you're not aware of that create that system that works.
I would rather be an optimist. I would rather say, let's assume it's possible and do our utmost to make it happen.
Yeah, yeah. Fair. I can't argue with that. I can't argue with that point of view. One thing I wanted to touch on with you would be about, I know that in the book as well, you talk about, in fact, I think this was in your TED talk, actually. I don't even think it was the book, but certainly I think it's mentioned in the book as well. The kind of character traits and strengths of perseverance, concentration, friendliness, empathy, resilience. Can you teach these? And if so, how do you think you would go about teaching, for example, things like perseverance or concentration?
You can't teach them if by teach you mean explain something to someone else and then expect them to do it. You know, you don't. Personality doesn't develop that way. Character doesn't develop that way. It's in a particular culture, and that's what my four books. And also, you know, this isn't just me. There are loads of schools, loads of research organisations, loads of chains of schools around the world who are developing this sophisticated kind of pedagogy, which transmits knowledge, which builds skills and literacies, and which also grows powerful and productive habits of mind, which kids are going to need. I just think it's ridiculous that if we teach kids in a way that encourages them to be passive and docile and extrinsically motivated and frightened of making mistakes, that's not a good preparation for life. A much better preparation for life is to learn to be responsible, resourceful, resilient, imaginative, and creative. So if there are things that we can do, if there are ways in which we can structure our classrooms so that we are encouraging, it's like we're creating an undertow in the classroom, which is pulling youngsters in the direction of enjoying struggling, grappling with difficult things, of learning how to try and get themselves out of difficulty on their own or with the collaboration of a partner, who are learning to build their own ability to manage distractions and to stay focused and to stay on task. From the psychology, we know all of these things are habits. They're not, you either got it, they're not kind of dyed in your genes. They're habits that reflect the cultures and environments in which you've grown up. So the skill is to create the classroom so that it is like an incubator of these habits. And a lot of my work for the last 20, 30 years has been to develop the pedagogy that makes that happen.
Could there be an argument, though, on the flip side of this, to say that the likes of perseverance, concentration, friendliness, empathy, resilience, and so on, they can be and are developed in what you would call the direct instruction, knowledge-rich classroom. Those things are still developed in those classrooms.
Are they? Give me an example of a classroom in which everything is explained to you up front, and then all you have to do is try and put it into practice and practice it and do a worksheet. For me, that's very different from all the classrooms where the students have an opportunity to grapple with something that is difficult before it's explained to them.
But I think
you have exploration.
Yeah, but I think that happens. I think that happens. So, for example, give you an example in practical context. Let's say it was as you described, before explaining or giving factual information or the information, you might have a starter where you might say, discuss with the person next to you this particular whatever, this particular issue. Or it could be, what do you already know about this? Or what, you know, whatever. There might be that kind of exploratory element for 5 minutes, say, or whatever, before the information. In a so-called direct instruction, knowledge-rich classroom, that for me, that would still happen. You would then also have questioning opportunities built in around the explanation. You'd have modeling opportunities as well, where that could be students modeling, it could be the teacher modeling, it could be some form of collaboration there, even if it isn't working in groups. So there's some examples within this so-called direct instruction classroom that would happen, in my opinion.
Yeah, but now this is no longer a pure direct instruction classroom. Now you're using mixed methods.
My overarching point is that there are very few schools where even some of the schools you cite where there is none of that happening, where they are literally coming into a classroom, they pick up their book, they open the book, the teacher tells them a list of facts, or they rote learn a list of facts, then they do a worksheet or a task, and then they do a quiz at the end, and that's every single lesson. That's all that happens in every lesson. I'm struggling to think of schools that do just that.
Sure. So now we're talking about the way real teachers really teach in the real world. Remember, my argument is not with what's going on in schools. My argument is with people who are claiming that the extreme end of direct instruction is the only valid way to teach. And that influences teachers' self-confidence, and it undermines their intuition and their sense of purpose when they use mixed methods. It's like these claims, like discovery learning does not work, right? That's a ridiculously strong claim, because the example you've just given me has an element of discovery built into it. So it doesn't help to polarize this conversation into black and white, yet that's precisely what some of these authors have been doing.
Yeah, I mean, I can't really speak for them, for those authors. And I know you mentioned in the book that the kind of DI lobby, as you call it, the DI people. It sounds like the DIY people, an advert for kind of like, you know, people who come around and fix things for you, the KR people. But these people, I'm not so sure without... You can be a proponent of direct instruction, a strong proponent of direct instruction as one of, if not the strongest way to teach. And I'm not saying I agree with that, but let's say you are a proponent of that. And you're saying that I believe direct instruction is the strongest way to teach. You can be that, but I'd be surprised if those people also said, you know, never do I want a child to turn around to a student within the lesson and have a collaborative discussion with that student for 5 minutes each lesson or something, or to kind of do a collaborative question and answer with the teacher, or to do some collaborative modeling, or do you know what I mean? I haven't come across that. I haven't seen that, but that's not to say there aren't people out there who say that and who believe that. I know there's people who are strong proponents of direct, of a certain way of teaching. I'm fully aware of that. But also, on the other side, there is as well. There are people who would argue that kind of the learning of facts or direct instruction or knowledge organizers or not has no place in a classroom. There would be people over the other side of the spectrum who would argue that that's the case. So all I'm saying is, do you think that... within your book, and I recommend everyone pick it up and have a read, The Future of Teaching, do you think that you address both sides of that argument, as in you've got the DI KR people lobby, and then what's on the other side?
I'm not sure if I understand the question.
I'm saying the whole book
is saying we need models of teaching which are capable of producing desirable outcomes of three different kinds. Children gain useful knowledge, they develop skills and literacies, and they are systematically coached to develop useful attitudes or habits of mind, which we know from all the research are predictive of leading successful, productive life. What I'm interested in is developing our knowledge base and our skill base about what those forms of pedagogy are. Most of the writing about direct instruction / knowledge-rich approaches to curriculum do not give very much attention to the need to explicitly cultivate those learning dispositions. Filling people with knowledge does not automatically build their capacities to be critical and creative. You need a particular kind of pedagogy, which is what you've been giving me examples of, which does both those jobs simultaneously. That's what I'm interested in.
I actually, by the way, Guy, I'm playing a bit of devil's advocate here. I don't know if you noticed, and I'm trying to draw out your opinions and thoughts. But actually, there's a lot that I really like about what you're saying. I want to make that clear. The one thing,
you're doing a good job of being the devil.
Thank you very much. There is a quote in the book which I really liked. A part where you said, people forget there is no best way to teach. You can't say what is best until you have specified the purpose of the teaching. Can you, and I know we're running out of time because we've only got a couple of minutes, like a minute left with you. So this can be our last point, but what can you expand on that again? I'll just read it again for everybody. People forget there is no best way to teach. You can't say what is best until you have specified the purpose.
Yeah. Absolutely. And that, you know, that's the problem with simplistic, you know, the like with best practice or, you know, discovering what works, which sometimes talk about as if there were one best way of teaching. So, for example, teaching to get short-term gains in relatively literal types of knowledge retention, problem solving, knowledge retention tasks direct instruction is a pretty effective way of doing that. But the evidence is that if you do that, if you teach in a way which is geared towards test results, which most of the research on teacher effectiveness is, then what you don't notice, but which a lot of research is now revealing, is that that method of teaching very often has a negative effect on developing children's curiosity and collaboration and resilience. I've got a research paper on my desk at the moment, 2021, bang up to date. It says, children persist, the title is, children persist less when adults take over. In other words, there is, if adults do too much of the organizing and the planning and the explaining, that could get you good test results, but you have to know that there can be a cost in terms of the development of the learning dispositions with that method of teaching. That's what I'm saying.
Guy, it's been an absolute blast. Mal has perhaps texted in with the concluding remark, which is, this trad prog divide is total bleep. Mr. Kringle says, agreed. And then Mal said, yes, totally, totally agree, in two separate texts. I think she totally agrees, Guy.
Well, so,
yeah. So listen, thank you ever so much for giving up the time for Teachers Talk Radio and for myself for this interview. It's been an absolute blast and a pleasure. And good luck with everything, with the new book. And it's called The Future of Teaching and the Myths.
The title is The Future of Teaching and the Myths That Hold It Back.
Oh yeah, I was coming on to that bit, Guy. I just left a dramatic pause future of teaching and the myths that hold it back.
Excellent.
All right, Guy, it's been a blast. Thanks very much.
Okay, yeah, it's been a lot of fun, Tom. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Guy. Cheers. Bye-bye. Bye-bye. And there goes Guy. So thank you, everybody, for joining me this morning on the morning break. I know I'm slightly over at 10:17, but I couldn't really resist a bit more of a debate with Guy about his book. I hope you've got as much out of this discussion as I have. I've got loads out of it. I thoroughly enjoyed the conversation. And there's a lot really to take away from that in terms of the different challenges that Guy is putting over to us to think about. And certainly, I think it is something for every educator to consider. Thanks, everybody, for joining. And later on, we've got two more shows. We've got The Drive Home with Seb Ventura, and we've got The Late Show with Genevieve Bent on a Thursday. And I think those two shows are going to be streamed live too. So you can now listen to some of our shows on Twitter, Facebook, and YouTube live. Most of our shows actually are currently streamed. A few of them aren't, but we are moving to a place where they are. If you want to volunteer with Teachers Talk Radio and become a tech volunteer with us and help us and support us with our streaming of free content for teachers, then please get in touch with me via Twitter at Rogers History, or get in touch with us at teacherstalkradio@gmail.com. So drop us an email and say, look, I'm interested in helping out with your streaming of shows. So it'd be fantastic to hear from any volunteers who want to help out with that. You don't have to be interested in hosting. This is literally behind the scenes tech support and IT support and streaming support. So thank you ever so much. And we will see you next time on Teachers Talk Radio.
You've been listening to Teachers Talk Radio. Tune in live and listen back at ttradio.org. We look forward to hearing from you next time on Teachers Talk Radio.